I'm George Liston, CA. There are no unimportant lives. Each of us, in our allotted time on Earth, writes a unique story with our thoughts, words, and deeds. We are all a part of the whole, and the sum of our stories is what we call history. This is one man's story, drawn on the themes of war, religious inquiry, and national tradition that define so much of the latter 20th century in this country. My guest is Lawrence Ammon, who works as a tour guide and writer in Washington, D.C. Larry, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a delight to talk to you, Larry. You are living an interesting life, and as I indicated, it's a life that very much reflects many of the great themes and questions of our society. In fact, Larry, you were born in 1946, and that of itself meant that you came of age in the most turbulent period in American history, I would wager, the Vietnam years of the last century now. Your educational influences included the seminary and also Wayne State University, a very fine public institution that I think has a, or at least had certainly in that period, a reputation for activism. I'm sort of wondering how those influences melded together in your mind.
Well, it was quite a contrast, believe me. People at Wayne State knew I was a Catholic. Some of them knew I had attended the local seminary. So I got a lot of anti-Catholic stuff that I had to deal with there. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was during the height of the anti-war activism. And I was a moderate, a political moderate, because I was a Johnson supporter mm-hmm. and a supporter of the war. Of course, to the left, you had the anti-war people or socialistic people, and to the right, you had everyone else.
Right.
So as a result of my experience at Wayne, I understand the continuing conflict between the baby boomers, mm-hmm. the continuing cultural and political conflict, because you were not allowed at Wayne State to get up and develop a right-wing argument.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who tried to, say, to argue against the welfare state or sometimes even to argue in favor of the war in Vietnam was immediately laughed down.
Right.
So that's an insight today for the bitterness, so to speak, of the right-wingers from that era?
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that because, in fact, that Vietnam experience was formative for so many, and I think you're quite right, the roots of the antagonisms date back to that period. But I'm also very curious about the religious conviction you took into life, and I'm sure still maintain, but must have been at the core of whatever political decisions you were making. How did that interact?
Absolutely. As a Catholic growing up in the 50s, there was that residual anti-communism, mm-hmm. which made me believe, say, in the domino theory or in the morality of fighting communism. Mm-hmm. The decision to enter the army and to get to Vietnam was my own. I felt I owed it since I was in favor of the war.
Mm-hmm. So that's the connection. And when you
Absolutely.
Went to war, Larry, you went, I think, in the field of intelligence, is
that's
that correct?
That's right. Uh-huh.
And to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You served in a wide array, judging from your resume, of places and locations and responsibilities. That makes it almost impossible to characterize simply, but I've got to ask you to do it. What did you feel from the experience there on the ground?
What I felt from the experience on the ground was it wasn't in the hands of the United States. For 6 months, I was with a mechanized battalion of the 1st Infantry Division. We went all over Three Corps. We went to these terrible places like the Iron Triangle and the Trapezoid. Not much happened while I was there, mm-hmm. fortunately. And the image of Vietnam that has been burnt into my mind is the Vietnamese looking at us as we went through the countryside in the armored personnel carriers. Mm. They would look up, down, beyond us. They didn't want to look directly at us. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't want us, they didn't want to be identified with us, but they didn't want us to know what they were really thinking either.
Mm-hmm. So you sensed a gulf between our forces and the native population?
Exactly, yes.
And that lasted through your entire experience there?
Yes, it certainly did.
Mm-hmm. How did it leave you feeling, I mean, as a young man coming? You went into it voluntarily. You volunteered
yes, that's
in the
right.
Army.
Right.
And as a reflection of your feelings about the entire issue.
Yes, of that and war. Also it was a male getting into a war. I thought was the male birthright.
Mm-hmm.
It was something you did, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and gave you a somehow it made you more mature,
mm-hmm.
which I think it does, but it's quite a cost. My year in Vietnam put my feelings about the war on hold.
Because you had to do what you had to do.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. It just didn't give me the environment for philosophical ruminating or second-guessing.
Right.
Now, that began as early as my assignment in Germany. Mm-hmm. I had a 3-year obligation, so when I was done with Vietnam, I had a year and a half in Germany.
Right.
Now, the contrast between the two theaters hit me right away.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans liked having us. Of course, this mm-hmm. is right after the Soviet invasion of
right,
Czechoslovakia.
Right. So you didn't have a sense of being alienated from the host population as you were, as you had felt in Vietnam.
Exactly, exactly. There's no question in my mind why we were in Germany, and the questions were being raised all the time about why we were ever in Vietnam.
I'm going to talk to you about that period. There's a period just after Vietnam and Germany, I think it's back in this country, 1970
yes.
to 73.
Exactly.
When you spend a long time reflecting on all of this, and I want to
yes.
come directly to that in a moment.
Yes.
But before that, Larry, I have to ask you this because it is the question of the day. I mean, the New York Times this very day and its op-ed page had no less than three huge articles written by different people on the Vietnam experience in this year, 2004. I mean, it's come back with a vengeance,
uh-huh.
and I wonder what your reaction to that is. I mean, why do you think the topic is a presidential issue right now in the campaigns?
Mm-hmm.
But why do you think it's lived this long with this degree of vehemence, if you will?
Because we still don't have the answers to it. That's why. None of us wants to say our participation was totally wrong or totally in vain.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, hardly anyone would say it was important to U.S. interests.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a inability of either side, I think, to completely abandon your position or to completely identify with the other person's position.
That makes sense to me. And that sounds, but it also sounds very generational, Larry, like your cohort, if you will, and life is going to go all the way through with that
right.
as a burning issue.
Right.
Never to be decisively ended.
Right.
Very interesting. Now, as I mentioned, Larry, and because you're obviously, and anyone listening can quickly grasp, a very thoughtful person, there is this period from 1970 to 1973, roughly.
Right.
And you're back in this country, and as you put it in your own resume, the war experiences, the changes in the church and life itself become kind of a big mix that you are thinking your way through. I'm very curious about anyone's period of introspection in life. You know, what kinds of questions were you asking yourself? And I suppose, obviously, what kinds of answers, even tentative ones, were you coming to?
Yes, well, the great question about everything, the Catholic Church, the war in Vietnam, the United States of America, was how could I have been so wrong earlier?
Mm-hmm.
How could the Catholic Church have been so wrong before Vatican II?
Mm-hmm.
How could I have been so wrong in my beliefs in the 1950s? How could I have been so wrong as to have believed in the domino theory or that the communization of South Vietnam posed a threat to the United States?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the behind the mental anguish and the theme of all the second-guessing or ruminating I was
mm-hmm.
doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite profound, though. Do you do that kind of thing? I mean, as I said before, I'm fascinated by when any of us, any human being, takes the experiences of our lives and tries to make sense of them. Did you do that in isolation? Did you do that in communication with others? Did you do it through reading, all of the above? I mean, what kind of exercise is that? And I guess, let me tie something into that just occurred to me. Does it stay with you?
Yes, absolutely. Well, the idea that I can be wrong and figuring out why I was wrong and saying, what does this mean for my assumptions today, is something that has always stayed with me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the beginning of wisdom, the ability to look back and say, I was wrong. Why was I wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What does this say about my thought process?
Mm-hmm.
That's what, and I think wisdom's the highest gift we can get from our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And diversity of experiences and reference point is an important contribution to wisdom. What did I use as reference points? I used things like watching John Kerry on television before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, here I was now firmly against the war in Vietnam, but I didn't like some of the things he was saying about what U.S. troops had done in general. I took that a little personally, and I thought, geez, if this guy wants to go somewhere in politics, he's going to have to eat that someday.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking that. Also, I did, yes, I did a lot of reading. I also wrote short stories on my experiences. Some of the writing that I thought was very relevant was the fiction writers who came out of the First World War. Hemingway and Eric Maria Remarque.
Mm-hmm. All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yes, that was his first and his greatest. But then he had three or four afterwards on his experiences as the veteran of the Lost War trying to reintegrate himself into society. No Road Back, I think, was number two, mm-hmm. which starts with just a couple days before the armistice.
Right.
And his first year or two trying to become a civilian again.
Right. What I'm taking from all of this is that, to paraphrase a famous quote, the examined life is worth living. And that's, I think, what you made up your mind to do.
Yes, and
experience.
Good job, George, putting it positively. I've quoted the negative
many
times. The unexamined
right.
isn't.
Right, right, indeed. Now, Larry, as life progresses and things, you know, your life has so many interesting themes and counter-themes and, to it. By the late 70s, you're here in Washington. And among the things you do, and this, I think, introduces something that I found very fascinating, you've done a lot of reading, done a lot of writing, and now you write a baseball book. Tell us about that. What does that amount to?
Well, baseball history was always a hobby of mine. My father was a great storyteller about baseball from his experiences as a boy in Michigan in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. He piqued my interest with his stories about watching Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb in action in the 1920s in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So as a historian, I thought this is one aspect in which I could put my talents to work. I've had articles printed in the Society of American Baseball Research Journal, and I was a contributor to the Baseball Encyclopedia, now defunct. I wrote an article on baseball families that I updated every 2 years. I wrote a professional biography on Ty Cobb. I have all the data on all of his 3,000 games, and I still get calls once in a while from people, tell me about this game mm-hmm. or that game. The editor of the baseball record book called me 2 years ago, and he said, we've got to get every run scored by Cobb straight because Ricky Henderson is about to break his record. Mm-hmm. We got to be absolutely sure of that mm-hmm. number.
And so you were the source.
So I was the source, yeah.
Wow, fascinating. What does baseball represent to you? I mean, why do you have this interest in it?
Baseball represents something that doesn't change that much. Mm. Something that has values that last through generations. Mm-hmm. I met some of the difficult days with my father back in the 1960s. Baseball is the one thing that kept us together.
Wow. It's interesting. When I made a note to myself to ask you that question, I also jotted the word tradition down.
Yes.
I think that's at the heart of what you're talking about.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Right now. Larry, let me take a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Lawrence Ammon, who works as a tour guide and writer in Washington, D.C. Larry, you bring to this your current work a very deep dimension here, and I want to bring this out because you don't just take people places and show them things. I think you strive to bring history into it. And history seems to be a very personal love of your own. You've conducted tours in many places around the Washington area, but also Gettysburg, Manassas, and so forth.
Yes.
I guess so the question here is, what's the meaning of history to you? I mean, why do you approach it this way? Why are you so fascinated by it?
It means a lot more when you can say, so-and-so did this on this spot. Or as I say often to the eighth grade kids, imagine you're standing here and you're so-and-so and such a thing is going on.
Mm-hmm. You have had a number of celebrity people we would recognize as celebrities that you have taken on these tours. Do you always approach it the same way, whether it's a celebrity that you're guiding about or just an average citizen?
I'd like to think so. I always try to gear it to that particular person's background. For example, I've had people from 40 different states mm-hmm. on tour here, and I always have my state's card ready to go. Mm-hmm. That state's card says, where's that state on the Lincoln Memorial? What are its two statues inside the Capitol? What presidents have come from that state? Are there any buildings in town named after them? Where is their avenue in Washington, D.C.? Mm-hmm. This is a great way to build trust. Mm-hmm. Also, I'm on a campaign to get to all 50 states. I'm up to 45 now.
Right.
So I can say to people from this state, yes, I was in such and such a city and I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, I have had people on my American Youth Hostel tour, which I do as a volunteer in the off season, from 59 different countries.
I was going to ask about that. How do you handle that, the foreign guests? And what are they curious about when they come here? What kinds of remarkable moments have you known just dealing with them?
The remarkable moments are when I get them talking about their country's history. Koreans talking about the experiences of their grandparents when we're at the Korean Memorial, mm-hmm. for example.
Mm.
Or when I start talking to, I have had a couple good experiences with young people in People's Republic of China, talking about the perceptions of our two different countries or the miscommunications in the Korean War. Mm-hmm. That has been another memorable moment.
Wow.
I like to throw in little things like, say, at the FDR Memorial, if anyone's from the Netherlands, I say FDR was proud of his Dutch heritage. He enjoyed having Queen Wilhelmina at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And tell them about the Netherlands Carillon across the river, sometimes
right,
take
right.
them to that. But these are examples of things that I would bring in. Probably the British are the best students of American history.
Really?
I've had terrific questions from them, or terrific comments. If I could give you one example.
Please do.
We were about to leave the basement of the Jefferson Memorial. I always show the painting of the Committee of Five submitting the Declaration. And I say, or you don't see them, but I say they're submitting it to the president of the Continental Congress, a man named John Hancock, who signed it in large letters so George III could read it without his spectacles. A young British man said, "Oh, yes, that's where you Americans get your expression, put your John Hancock down here." I was so impressed.
Uh-huh.
It was just such a great moment of rapport there.
Yeah. You know, listening to you, Larry, I get the sense you strive for moments of rapport with your tour guides. It's not just a job.
Oh, exactly. Yes, because the people on the American Youth Hostel tour are a little surprised to say, "Who pays you for this?" Because they're kids making their around-the-world tour. I don't expect money from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, nobody does. I do it out of love. Mm-hmm. Because, well, self-calculation, too. All I learn about your countries.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes their reaction to American history.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to be an amateur psychologist, but I guess I'm going to be one for a moment at least. Oh. Because listening to you, Larry, and trying to connect the threads of your life, this very interesting life, as I say, and now when I hear you relating to these young people that way, I think of you as a very young man.
Exactly.
As a student. And I'm wondering, are you making a connection there as well? I mean, this everything, the faith, you obviously still feel very strongly, and well, what are those connections? Are there connections there?
Exactly. I'm doing this for these people because they're in the same situation I was in the fall of 1970. I took what we call European separation from mm-hmm. the Army. I didn't fly back to the States right away.
Mm-hmm.
You had a 3-month grace period.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent that time traveling all around Western Europe, watching mm-hmm. my pennies all the way. And then finally, I got the military flight from Frankfurt to Philadelphia, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
So these young people are in the same situation, trying to learn everything they can about other countries and to be immersed in it.
Right. Do you have any, when these people pass through your life in a sense, but is there any further contact that you've had?
A few times, and some of it's very valuable. For mm-hmm. example, 2 years ago, I had a man, 22 or 23, from the Bavarian part of Germany. He was active in the Christian Social Union, the sister party of the Christian Democrats in Germany, and now he's a local government official.
Mm.
So he and I still write back and forth.
Mm. Interesting. Writing.
Yes.
That's a magic word with you, Larry, because in addition to the baseball book and this correspondence with people that you meet in the context of guiding tours and so forth, you've also written novels, essays, and so forth.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that. That's a very interesting kind of a side to anyone's activity in life.
Well, the highlight of my career as an essay writer was back in 1979. I got one in the guest column of the old Washington Star.
Mm-hmm.
This title was Job Hunting in Washington. I was a security guard working at the minimum wage
mm-hmm.
and always trying to do better. And I really excoriated the average Washington employer for throwing away resumes and mm-hmm. never giving responses or never giving a chance to someone who wasn't qualified or maybe overqualified.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the highlight of my essay writing career.
How do you feel about that particular question right now? Then you've been a resident here in Washington for quite
yes.
some time. What are your feelings about that kind of issue? And is it any better? I mean, do you have the sense that People are more caring and interested in others now, or more willing to give them attention in terms of jobs and so forth?
No, I really don't think so. What's lacking in Washington is that hometown feeling. And, of course, if you don't have that hometown feeling, you don't identify, I think, with your... Well, another thing is looking at it from the other point of view, since I'm not on the other end anymore looking for the job, we have the surplus of qualified people that we don't usually have.
Mm-hmm. In terms of your readings, Larry, they're also fascinating. The Psalms, for example, from the Bible are still a big interest of yours, I'm sure both for their beauty and their meaning. Also, a book that I'm familiar with, I don't know how many still read it, Markings by Dag Hjermarskjöld, the former UN Secretary. Why that book particularly?
That book in particular because here is a man supposedly at the peak of public esteem who's constantly looking in his soul and seeing all his spiritual limitations, always trying to root out the selfishness and the self-seeking from him. He is someone who's just never satisfied, never resting on his laurels, emotionally, mentally, and most important of all, spiritually.
Is that something you do?
I'd like to think so, yes. Mm-hmm. I write a diary every day. I've got 38 years worth of them, though.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's a kind of both intellectual and spiritual exercise.
Exactly.
Well said. Mm-hmm. Hemingway is also one of your favorite authors. Now, I know you were born in Michigan,
and exactly. The
Up in Michigan stories are a big part of his oeuvre, as they say. But why are you find yourself attracted to his work?
Well, it's not because I like bullfighting. The last novel, I finally got around to reading Death in the Afternoon, the last one of his novels I hadn't read. And it's not because I think I'm very macho. It's because I think it's his writing style. The idea that less is more in what you write and in what you say. Mm-hmm. That's why he endures so well, in spite of the fact he's not politically correct right now.
Right.
Like any writer, of course, he's got great quotations, great bits of wisdom. But when you don't have to root through all the wrappings around the present, then I think it's more impressive, and that's true with Hemingway.
Yeah, that economy of language is really remarkable. And again, I agree with you. I think some of his themes have been a bit surpassed by time, but the coherent beauty of the language is still breathtaking. What about your own novels? You've written a couple of novels, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I tried to update or copy Eric Maria Remarque's No Road Back, about someone trying to integrate himself back into American society after the Vietnam War. It'd be a little embarrassing to go back and read it today because of all the prophetic things I said that didn't turn out at all.
Well, yeah, but still, I think that's a remarkable exercise. You actually then, let me make sure I understand this, you took your own personal experience and that of others, and through fiction, which I always maintain is some truer than fact in many cases, tried to get the meaning out of it.
Exactly.
What was the title of that?
No Road Back.
No Road Back. No Road Back.
Yes. I just took Remarque and altered it a bit.
Yeah. Now, and you've written other novels as well.
That's my only full-length novel, I must confess.
I still think it's remarkable to have undertaken that. Quotes and the things that people find attractive that either they have said originally or they've found meaningful from others, I find a great insight into an individual. And I think one of your favorite quotes is, "It gives you an intellectual force to see things differently."
Exactly.
Why is that true?
Because there's nothing that gives me more satisfaction than to see people thinking after I say something before they agree or disagree. Mm-hmm. And I've had that experience many times in life.
What about yourself? Because once again, going back to this theme of self-examination, I find in you, when you find your own mind changing about something.
Exactly. That works very well in terms of making an impression on other people. For example, in doing the American Youth Hostel tour, I'm giving these people really a introductory crash course on U.S. history. Mm-hmm. One of the things I have to do for a lot of people in Europe or a lot of people in other Western democracies is explain the popularity and the respect for Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And I start out, for example, by saying, I voted against the man twice, and it took a long time for me to concede, yes, he was a good leader and did some good things for the country in this, and that way. And by prefacing my remarks by saying I voted against him twice, I think I'm sure I have a lot greater credibility.
Mm-hmm. This is very interesting. Larry, as we conclude this conversation, it is fascinating, and I find these the most fascinating of our conversations because we look into another person's life, which you've helped us to do. And I think it's been a very philosophical exercise, certainly for me, and a very thoughtful one. I appreciate that. It seems to me that a big part of your own philosophy is the lessons, the value of the lessons of life, you know, what that really make it worth living. And to abridge a quote that you're fond of, that it takes a life to get to know those lessons, and the little new that we get from life is very costly and the only heritage we have to leave. Why is that kind of thought meaningful to you?
Well, that's what makes us different from everybody else. If we've learned anything from life, if we can say, this is what's unique in my life that I think can help somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that's taken from Hemingway in Death in the Afternoon. He just threw it in the middle of the bullfighting scene.
Is that right?
Yes. That's what makes it so makes it hit the eye so much.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's a matter of what did I learn that was unique that maybe nobody else ever learned and that I can pass on.
And each one of us has that capacity?
Each one of us has that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean we do it.
Since I'm on a roll, let me see if I can help the ante a bit more. Is there a responsibility that derives from that capacity? Each one of us has the capacity to learn something. Are we then obliged, Larry, and I suppose I'm speaking to the seminary student as well as the author, to do something about what we've learned?
Yes, absolutely. We have an obligation to do at least something activist to put our beliefs into practice.
Larry, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I've learned a lot.
Thank you, George, and you've brought it out well, I must say.
Thank you, Larry. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Lawrence Ammon, who works as a tour guide and writer in Washington, D.C. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our assistant producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.